You are responsible for 10 billion views on YouTube. Is that right?
We added it all up in the history of me doing YouTube, probably pushing 50 billion views.
Wow. Can you break down why that title thumbnail works?
I've never been more confident on uploading YouTube videos than I was with that video.
Really?
But how we packaged it could be the difference between it getting a couple million views and 28 million. Brand YouTube channels are corporate video dumping grounds.
I'm going to tell you guys the most recent upload to the Target YouTube channel.
Great.
Whoa.
Today on the Colin and Tamir Show, we're joined by YouTube expert and strategist, Patty Galloway. Now, we first came across Patty Galloway as fans of his channel. He was uploading breakdowns of creators like MrBeast, KSI, and Ryan Trahan, talking about why their channels were so successful. Now, one of the most interesting things about Patty is not only is he working with creators on their videos, he's also working with brands on their YouTube strategy. So, for example, he works directly with Red Bull on their videos, as well as the Philadelphia Eagles. It's one of the most fun parts of this conversation is talking about how brands are going to now occupy space on YouTube. In this conversation, we dive really deep into the strategies that top creators are using to grow their channels. We talk about ideas and what makes a good idea for YouTube, how to package it correctly, and we also talk about where YouTube is heading next. All right, now for our conversation with Patty Galloway. All right, Patty Galloway, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a long time coming and I'm excited to be here.
You refer to yourself as a view maxer, is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, view maximizer or something?
View maximizer, you know, we get views. That's our kind of catchphrase for everything I do. I think in this industry, it's important to like know what you're good at. And there's so many different things I could describe myself as. But when I really trace back what I do with the people we work with and what I've spent the bulk of my life doing, it's getting more views for YouTube videos. So yeah, the view maximizer, I'll take it.
You've also been doing this for a while. You were a creator yourself on your own channel. That's how we got connected.
Yeah, that's how we met. Yeah.
Yeah, like we exchanged DMs so long ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound crazy and this is like a beautiful thing to think about how long YouTube has been around. But I believe I posted my first video in 2006 on like the first channel I ever built. And that's nearly 20 years ago. So it's like kind of crazy to think that YouTube's been around for that long. And I know you guys as well started in the same way, like so long ago. You know, we've all been on the platform for over a decade, obsessing over it. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
And we're actually, this is 20 years of YouTube now.
Yeah.
So it's super interesting that we're at this 20 year mark. And I think it's an interesting place to start about the evolution of YouTube. When we first uploaded our videos onto the platform to what it is today, I think there was this assumption when we first started our channel that maybe this could be the modern version of television. But for that to play out, it actually took a really long time to get there. But where do you think YouTube is today?
I mean, I'm going to sound like a kind of very bullish person on YouTube, as I'm sure we all are at this table. But I really think for the longest time, the mainstream sort of looked as YouTube as like this kind of like, oh, place for internet clips and like, oh, now there's vloggers running around doing pranks and oh, now there's this thing and now, oh, now there's Mr. Beast doing all these like big stunts. But the more you kind of look at the play YouTube is making and you even listen to what Neil Mohan, the CEO, is saying, like YouTube is the biggest streaming platform in the world. So YouTube is TV. Nowadays, the production level people are putting into their YouTube videos at the highest level, it's almost like movie-esque. So YouTube is kind of Hollywood. And even the stat that surprised me was that YouTube is now the platform with the highest podcast viewership. More people watch podcasts on YouTube in the US than any other platform, which also means YouTube is kind of the new radio. So I am very bullish on YouTube just being this kind of major winner in the whole future of entertainment. And I think that's like the exciting thing about being still so early in it, in my opinion.
You didn't even mention music.
YouTube
music is a massive platform. So yeah, I think you're right that it is this like one-stop shop for entertainment that does make it harder to compete, right? Like when you're living in a world now where, you know, a massive podcast gets uploaded on the same day as thousands and thousands of other videos, I think there's a stat that we saw that only 12% of YouTube videos crack 1,000 views.
That doesn't surprise me, but that's crazy to think.
It's crazy to think about that. And so I think it's a good place to start of like in today's world, what can break through?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think to me, we just look at like where YouTube has come from a few, even like 5, 10 years ago, I think it was still so focused on individual personalities that maybe they were just early to do YouTube and they were doing it at a decent level and they built an audience through that. And lots of them are really talented. Like I'm thinking of a Casey Neistat. But in more recent years, I think it has become more of a strategy space. Like you have to really dig into like the strategic sides of YouTube. It's not enough to just be like funny and interesting on camera. That goes a long way. But nowadays you look at the top creators and they're actually like, you know, they're entrepreneurs, they're data analysts, they're managers of teams, they're leaders altogether. And I think when we think about how competitive it is right now, that is true. Like there's probably never been a point in history of YouTube where there's more good videos being uploaded every week. But the eyeballs is also bigger. There is a bigger total audience. And I think the YouTube algorithm as well has got so good at allowing the cream to rise to the top and become such a meritocracy versus maybe how it was 5-10 years ago, that I see this all the day in the work that I do. These smaller creators, when they start to focus on the right things and put attention on the kind of new things, the new rules that are working on YouTube, they can see crazy results very quickly. So I think it's more competitive than it's ever been, but it's also, if you can deliver a really interesting title, thumbnail, and video, the kind of multiplier effect of YouTube's algorithm and how far that can reach, even as a small channel, has never been greater. So it's kind of like a balancing act where competition is higher, but also I think the algorithm is so much more sophisticated and there's a total market that's bigger, that when you hit it right, it's pretty frightening how quickly you can grow a channel.
What does it take to hit it right? Like when you say hit it right and you're working with creators or you're working with brands, what has to come together so that you've hit it right, you've maxed all your views? What's happening?
So I think the interesting thing, and I've said this before, but I think because YouTube is a video platform, people do look at it and say, well, it's all about the video. It's all about the content. It's all about, you know, the cameras and the production. And I know this is not a talking point that's particularly new, but YouTube is not a video platform. It's a click and watch platform. It's a platform that people have to decide what to view. Even when you compare it to other video platforms like TikTok, TikTok feeds you content based on your algorithm, based on your watch history, and they're really good at it. But YouTube long form, at least, is still a decision platform. So to me, like the first step is always just like really nailing down what ideas we're going to make for a channel. So when I think about these smaller channels that are growing really quickly, it's usually that they have actually invested more time into ideation. And just before we went live, we were even talking about some examples, but like I recently had a channel in our accelerator program who was doing 2,000 or 3,000 views a video. His name is Ian Lore Astro. He's an astrophotography channel. And he was making content and there was nothing terribly wrong with how he was making the videos. Like the videos were pretty good, but they were doing 2,000 or 3,000 views a video. And I'd love to take a lot of credit for it, but the reality of it is we were just like, hey, like spend more time on ideation, study what's working in other niches, try to build a video that we define as having a CCN fit, which is it hits the core audience, hits the casual audience, and it hits the new audience all at the same time, which sounds easy, but it's actually quite hard because sometimes what's really interesting to a new audience alienates a core audience. And sometimes what's really interesting to a core audience is just narrowing the total potential market the video can hit. So he just used some of these frameworks around ideation and just spent more time on his packaging. He changed it from maybe being a situation where he was spending 5% of time on idea, title, thumbnail to maybe spending 30% of time on idea, title, thumbnail. And he made a video that got 1 million views and did, I think, 270 times his average viewership.
What was that video?
That video was photographing the Milky Way in 1 hour or in 10 minutes, 1 hour and 24 hours, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we can show it on screen, but it was, yeah, just a video just with astrophotography at different time levels. Yeah. And it was built on a format that had worked for other people, like, yeah, 5 minute haircut versus 50 minute haircut or, mm-hmm, you know, whatnot. So it was really interesting to see just how big of a multiplier YouTube can be.
Can you break down why that title thumbnail works as opposed to like, I photographed the Milky Way?
Yeah.
Right. Instead of in 10 minutes, yeah, an hour and 24 hours or whatever it was.
I think because immediately that poses like an interesting question of like, what do the different levels of time investment look like for this thing? There's also like a clear comparison. And like, I think just naturally viewers are interested in comparisons, like whether it be a body transformation, whether it be like a $1 jet versus like $100 billion jet or whatever. I think viewers are just fascinated by comparisons and seeing how different things take different amounts of time or investment. So I think that just, it built on a format, and also that format makes for a really interesting thumbnail because you can show the different levels of effort and how that photo ends up coming out. So I think it just takes it from being like, realistically, this is the beautiful thing, is there's not that much difference between that video and a video where you just say like taking a photo of the Milky Way or whatever.
Yeah.
But those little differences can just have such outsized returns, which I, it breaks my brain sometimes because, you know, we've had a situation as well where we worked with this creator, his name was Tim Gabe, and he had a video which was six UI hacks or something like that, user interface hacks for website design. And someone on my team helped advise him on just like a tiny thumbnail change. And the difference between the thumbnail he had before and the thumbnail he had afterwards was, I would say maybe it was like 30, 40% better, the one afterwards. Like it wasn't a huge difference. But the video ended up getting 40 times more views per day just because it was a little bit better with a lot more people. And then YouTube just snowballed it from there. And that's what breaks my brain. And I think what a lot of creators like fail to realize is how much of a difference those small details can make. So often, like, I think people are looking for this complete like tear down and like everything's wrong, we need to build it up again with this new strategy. Sometimes it is about just like realizing where you need to invest more time and focus and just improving those little details.
Do you remember what was 30 or 40% better about it?
We made it clearer. We can actually give you the title thumbnail so you can show it on screen for the viewers, but it was just a simple thing. It just made it a little bit clearer. It was easier to look at. We removed some of like the excess busyness, just made this really clear thumbnail. I think we put like a little cursor on screen, so like you're clicking onto for the UI elements. And if you just look at them side by side, it's like a little bit better. But yeah, 40 times more views per day after that thumbnail change.
It is interesting how exponential it is. And just back to what you said about like YouTube being a click and watch platform. I think that's a really important note. So we built a program called the YouTube Growth Playbook, and it's centered around what we consider the three rules of YouTube. So I'm going to pitch them to you and see how you feel about them. The first is obvious. It's if they don't click, they don't watch. And it's something that Jimmy said to us on our show that ever since he said that, I'm like, that is such an obvious statement, but it is... It is the first rule of YouTube, plain and simple. The second is once you've earned someone's click, the second rule is respect their time, which means like now that they're inside of the video, you have to really respect the fact that they gave you that time and essentially introduce, if the thumbnail is a question, you now have to introduce a new question that allows them to stay until the end, right? There has to be a reason for them to invest that time and get value back. And the third rule is a question, which is, do you want more stuff like this? So basically every video that you upload has to answer the question of, if I asked you, if you liked one of my videos, then I have to ask you, well, do you want more stuff like that? My next video is like that too, to basically allow you to jump, right? So like you talk about that space photographer of going from, you know, that format, I'd have to imagine he repeated that format.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And in his next videos. Yeah.
And it's not necessarily just repetitive of like, hey, just make the same video over and over again. It's actually empathetic towards the audience's experience. The majority of our viewership comes from browse and suggested. So it's beyond even just being a click and watch platform. It's where are the surfaces that they can click? Mm-hmm. And the assumption, I think the base assumption when people are coming into YouTube is that it's the channel page. You know, or like if I put out the video, then maybe that, but it's actually not, it's not there. It's on the home screen.
Yeah.
Or more importantly is the right bar next to the rest of the videos. So you actually have to reverse engineer and go, what video are they watching right now that would get them to click on my video?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
We always say too, with if they don't click, they don't watch, that the goal is that your video should be familiar to the audience, but also unexpected. So this creator who's making this aerospace photography video, I'm sure there's a lot in that thumbnail that looks like other aerospace photography videos. But the element that's unexpected is the way that the thumbnail is divided into three, right? That's what's unexpected. Right. So like within that sea of aerospace photography, if I'm looking for a video to watch, ooh, there's the one that's unexpected. Yeah. It's familiar to me, but it's also unexpected. I'll click.
You're using like a classic YouTube template, which is this like three step. Right? Johnny Harris has a great video too, a great thumbnail that's similar. Let me pull it up because it's exact. Let me show it to you guys. It's
about having different income levels.
Oh, I saw
that. How your life looks and feels and operates differently across those income levels.
Yeah.
So Johnny's video is called $25,000 versus $25 million. And it's a three-step with $25,000 and then in the middle, $100,000 and then at the end, $25 million. Yeah. But that is just like a clean, classic YouTube example of the titles and thumbnails don't necessarily exactly match, but
yeah,
they suggest this like three-step framework that just works.
I think what's inspiring to me, or at least makes me hopeful, is that no matter what your medium is or what your topic is on YouTube, you can use that format. I didn't think about us, like, could we do interviewing YouTube creators with zero subscribers or like 1,000 subscribers?
Yeah, up to a million.
A million, 100 million.
That's good, yeah.
Like 1,000 or 10,000 or something, a million and 100 million.
And something you just done there by like hearing me talk about this, talk about that video, you just come up with an idea for your channel, right? I think what's so interesting is when you start to realize that as a creator, you're not limited to what is happening in your niche. So often, like I look at, how do you ideate with, let's say a channel that does just like one focus area, let's say it's golf, but like, how do I ideate? And it's like, oh, like currently I go look at all the other golf channels and see what's working. And it's like, well, are there any other niches that have like a certain level of adjacency to golf? Like, is there other niches where you could take formats from that? And like even our format here of like, maybe it's a $1 versus $10 versus $100 golf club or something. Like you can apply formats in so many niches. And it's honestly, it sounds simple, but so much of our success through my consulting company, through the other things we do, it's just seeing what is working in all these different niches. And what are in our niche that we're currently focused on, what is a format that other people are not doing yet that we could bring over and adapt? And also, I think there's always like this feeling of like, well, we want to be original, we want to try something new. But there's a big difference between taking a format in your existing niche and doing it yourself, because then that competing channel might be like, hey, I did that first. Or one of your audience members is like, that's not original. If you take, like, if you're the astrophotography channel, you take that over, it feels fresh, it feels new. And maybe in other niches, that's now saturated and it's not as interesting. So it's so interesting how you can kind of take things over from different niches.
There's this method that we talk about quite a bit, called Be a Magician. And it's because one time we had a conversation with a magician who said to us, I don't have to come up with new tricks. I just have to show my tricks to audiences who haven't seen them before.
There we go.
And it like kind of blew me away, because I was like, that's true. Like, the space audience may have never seen that format before. Or before the recording, we were talking about permaculture, which is a massive genre on YouTube that I did not even know about. And you have a student from your accelerator who had a video with 15 million views by using essentially a versus framework, right? Or a before and after framework.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that video?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. So I think it was in cohort 2 of our accelerator program, which was close on 2 years ago. This channel, Andrew Millison is the name of the channel. And he was just in the cohort and, you know, he was pretty active, but like we didn't directly like tell him which video to make or anything. Like, this was on his own accord. So I'm not trying to take any credit for this, because this is him and his work. But I think he just realized from being around these other creators and hearing me talk about how we do YouTube at the highest level, he was like, wow, like I could probably package these videos to be bigger, broader. And yeah, he made this video about how the UN is holding back the Sahara Desert. And I think earlier I mentioned that idea of the core casual new audience. If you think about the core of like permaculture, horticulture, it's pretty small on YouTube. But if you attach it to like, okay, the UN and the Sahara Desert, and then you add like a really interesting thumbnail, which, you know, we can show that up on screen, but that thumbnail is like so irresistible not to click it.
Yeah, it's a split screen.
Yeah,
it's a split screen. Half of it is like a completely arid desert, and the right is a desert that has been completely transformed. It's green.
Yeah.
It's almost unbelievable, actually. And I think, to his credit, I clicked on the video sort of skeptical of, is that real? Like, is that an AI thumbnail or what is that? And the first frame is the lush green sort of desert that you see on the right. So it confirmed to me, okay, like this is actually the video I thought it was.
That what you just described there of like seeing a thumbnail that like almost you have to be like, no way, and then click it. That's what I'm always trying to create. Like, I want something that feels like maybe somewhat exaggerated and like so like, wow, that looks impossible, that you click the video, but then we deliver on it in some fashion. So that you just feel like, actually, I made the right decision by clicking this video.
All right, hope you guys are enjoying this episode with Patty. Wanted to tell you about something real quick before we continue. So we want to give 100 of you our 50 and 5 YouTube ideation sprint totally for free. This is our 5-day ideation sprint to help you come up with better ideas for your YouTube channel. Here's how it works. You click the link in our description, you put in your email, and every day for 5 days, you're going to get a video that teaches you something about titles and thumbnails. And you're going to get a prompt to push you to write 10 ideas for your YouTube channel. By the end of the 5 days, you're going to have 50 new ideas for your channel. So if you're interested in that, we're giving away 100 seats totally for free. Just click the link in our description or go to colinandsamir.com/ideas. All right, now back to the episode with Patty. So you are responsible for 10 billion views on YouTube. Is that right? Or more?
The latest we checked, it's around 10 billion views a year.
10 billion views a year.
Yeah, with the current clients we work with is around 10 billion views a year. If we added it all up in the history of me doing YouTube, it's probably pushing 50 billion views.
So there's a video that one of your, you know, one of the clients that you work with is Red Bull.
Yeah.
And Red Bull's probably at the forefront of a brand operating like a creator.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and that most likely will become a trend that we see to continue to rise on YouTube is brands operating like creators. But I bring up Red Bull because of those 10 billion views a year, there's one video that has 28 million views on Red Bull's channel that has this kind of versus framework that we can pull from, which is world's fastest camera drone versus F1 car. And it's a really clean and simple thumbnail. Can you talk about just ideating within that context of Red Bull, this video? Like, how do you bring that forward? Why did you know this was going to work, and why does it work?
I've never been more confident on uploading YouTube videos as I was with that video.
Really?
I didn't think it'd do 28 million because we were like averaging maybe a million views a video at the time, but I was so confident that would work. So I think if you go back, all these videos have like an origin story. And the first video I ever gave Red Bull any advice on was this video they did, which was mountain bike versus world's best camera drone or something, or world's best FPV drone. And that ended up doing really well for them. It did like, I want to say like 5 to 10 million views in that sort of range. And that was actually before we started working with Red Bull. That was like 3 years ago now. And I think that planted a seed just internally that, hey, this versus format's interesting. And drones, like fast camera drones, are interesting. And we also looked at the channel and we saw, well, what's working on the channel? Formula One content is obviously very popular and was working really well on the channel. And then building into like another component, which we can talk about, which is like trying to identify competitive advantages if you're a brand. This can also apply to creators and even small creators. Like, what is something unique that you can do that other people can't? And it's like, well, we have access to F1 cars. We have access to the world's best F1 driver, Max Verstappen. We have access and resources to be able to build a really fast camera drone. You start to put these pieces together and you're like, well, how interesting would a video be where you race the world's fastest driver in an F1 car against the world's fastest camera drone and try to actually get it to keep up? But the interesting thing about this video, and this kind of goes back to your points earlier about like, maybe the title thumbnail feeling almost like a little bit exaggerated, or not even like, could this be real? That video, when you actually look at it, it's actually not a race. It's the drone following the car. But if you think about that as a title, imagine the title was like, world's fastest drone tries to keep up with F1 car. That's interesting, but maybe that would have got 4 million views.
It's also kind of the end of the story. Because it like the way you titled that didn't work. Tries to keep up with.
Yeah.
You're like, didn't work.
Yeah.
And it's just moving like, on.
Even for a thumbnail, then maybe you show the drone following the car. But like just seeing that format, which was actually built and lifted from a format that works really well on the Red Bull channel, but also for other channels, which is like the drag race format, which if you ever see the channel Car Wow, they do these things like Bugatti Veyron versus Ferrari F-150 or something. And it's like these races with this behind camera angle. So we were like, let's take inspiration from that format that works really well. Let's put them together. Let's put a drone on the track. Let's put an F1 car on the track. And I mean, it's a beautiful thumbnail, in my opinion.
So how involved are you in the process of that video? Are you there and your team there from ideation all the way through completion, like looking at edits?
Yeah.
A video like that?
I like to think about it as like, we're strategists. So we don't do traditional production. Like we're not there on the set. We weren't there on the set of that video. But we'll work on the ideation. Like we'll work alongside Red Bull, like coming up with these ideas and working on those ideas. And I believe that original idea like was born internally at Red Bull from one of their producers, Callum. And we just worked with it to make sure that it's adapted to be able to hit the viewership they want. Mm. You know, so we actually took their original sort of semblance of an idea, figure it out and make it broader. So we'll advise on like the packaging, the title before the shoot. Like the producers will meet with my team and myself, and we'll just go through the shoot beats and just figure out how we're going to structure the video and what we're going to show. And then we'll do like edit reviews. And then the final thing for me is always like working. We actually make the thumbnails for Red Bull. For most of our clients, we don't make the thumbnails for Red Bull. We make the thumbnails. My amazing designer, Brittany, shout out to Brittany. And I say my designer, but she works for a lot of incredible creators. And my like biggest thing that always leads to the most friction with clients is usually like, I have a very strong opinion on what the title thumbnail should be. Mm-hmm. And I will like argue that case. And I even remember for that specific video, like I was like, perhaps one of the other titles and thumbnail combinations they were suggesting, I was like, it's good, but it could get 1 million views. My one, I think, can get 10 million views. I remember saying that, you know, because it sounds so small, but like even for a video that's so well executed, such an incredible piece of content, everyone that was involved in that content just did a phenomenal job. But how we packaged it could be the difference between it getting a couple million views and 28 million. So
I think it's a really interesting exercise to, this is actually something Jimmy said to us the first time we ever went to Greenville. He told us with our packaging, he said, pull it to the most exaggerated version of what it is, and then pull it back to what you're comfortable with. But explore the most exaggerated version of the concept. And I thought that was a really interesting mental framework and exercise. And one of my favorite videos, this is not necessarily exaggerated, but one of my favorite title thumbnails on YouTube is from Veritasium. And it is, why are there 96 million black balls on this reservoir?
Banger.
It is an unbelievable title thumbnail. It has 102 million views. And I think, you know, on the opposite end of what's the most exaggerated version of this, you know, he could have maybe gone like the 96 million mysterious black balls. I don't know. I think the title's perfect. But you can also go the other way and go, what's like the most boring version? And let's make sure we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Like that video is actually about how LA protects its water supply. So you
which would have just been a brutal title with a much smaller total addressable market.
So you said 103 million views.
Yeah.
If we had said, like, let's say we came in and we were the anti-strategists. Right. Like, let's say we start a company, our job is to get YouTubers the least amount of views possible. We'd go in and we'd be like, oh, like, interesting. How about we title it like how LA addresses its water shortage problem?
Right.
That video on even Veritas' channel with millions of subscribers might have got 500K views.
But with that, maybe.
With that title, I'm 103. Wow.
Yeah, it opens up a curiosity gap, right? Which is like the most important thing is like we need a curiosity gap. And I think what's interesting is we're starting to talk about, I think for the audience to latch onto, like there are some really interesting frameworks to start with when it comes to ideation. Like one is superlatives. So fastest, biggest, smallest. You see these a lot on YouTube. And I think superlatives are really easy visual words to latch onto. And I think that's important, right? The other is versus. Versus is a classic, like Ford and F-150 versus Rivian, right? Like immediately you peg two things against each other. And then we just talked about like the three step that we talk about quite a bit, the like $1, $10, $100, right? Those like three steps. So I think you start to, the most important thing, there's a Seth Godin quote that says, in order to be seen, you must learn how to see. Mm. And I think spending time on YouTube, just clocking what is the framework, like what are they using in this framework to capture my attention is the most important. And just writing it down, being like, oh, interesting, world's smallest X. How many times do I see superlatives show up like that?
Yeah. Another one that I've been seeing a lot that we've had some success with over the years is like getting exclusive access or getting access to something that most people don't get access to. Mm. So there's a creator, an Irish creator, shout out Irish creators, called Dara Taha, who does these videos where like he investigates these like secret islands or secret like military bases that have like pollution, and the, you know, he has to wear like a gas mask when he goes there. Another example is like we work with the creator Jesser, who's the biggest basketball creator. Like he'll do like getting access to the NBA, getting exclusive access to the finals. We did a video recently with a wildlife creator called Far Escalante, and that title was called Private Tour of Secret Indian Billionaire's Wildlife Sanctuary. And that got like 9 billion.
Everyone views. In the world watched that. Everyone.
9 million views. 9 billion in the future, not quite yet. But like, it's that format. It's like, even for maybe viewers listening, they'd be like, well, I don't have exclusive access to like an Indian billionaire's private wildlife sanctuary.
Right.
But it's like, maybe there's some things you get interesting access to, or you can showcase that other people can't. And I actually think, going back to like our original points of like, how do creators stand out in 2025 and beyond? I think it's becoming more important than ever to just lock in what your competitive advantage is. Mm-hmm. And for each of the clients that we work with, like, we actually have it internally in a document, which is like, what is their competitive advantage? Like, what do we see as the thing that makes them be able to make something or create content that other people can't make? And I think a lot of people just go to, oh, it's money. Oh, it's like access or these things. And yes, that can be a competitive advantage, but quite often it's just like unique experience or like a unique authority to speak on something that other people can't speak on and things like that. So, you know, anyone, that's actually an interesting point with like, even with the content I used to make on YouTube. When I used to do these breakdown videos, they did really well. But technically anyone can kind of make those.
Yeah.
But if I make a video talking about how I got 10 million views with clients, or how, you know, we work with clients that do 20 million a year in revenue or something directly from YouTube, there's probably only a handful of people in the world that can actually say that as well.
I also find that even if you don't have the money or the access, and let's say you're going with a title, thumbnail, and a concept that's more about your personal experience and your personal knowledge, sometimes that adds enough tension in itself of like, let me see if I believe you as an expert. Like, here's 10 things you can do to like improve your fitness or something or whatever. Like, I know that there are a lot of those types of videos, but occasionally I'll see one and I'll be like, okay, there's actually tension here that's going to make me click because I want to see if I believe your expertise. Yeah. Sometimes like that itself will bring you through the door.
What do you think about lists? Like, six financial tips or six, you know, like, what do you think about lists? Ali Abdaal is like a very forward list man.
Yeah.
Ali, if you're listening, hopefully you like that I called you a list man.
But he refers to himself as a forward thinking list man.
He said to us, he was like, a YouTube video is a title, thumbnail, and a list. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective. What do you think about like titles with like a title framework with a list in it?
I think if the items you're like showcasing are feel unique and interesting for your niche. So if you're, let's say, in the finance niche and you made a video which is like 7 money tips, you know, to grow your wealth. It's kind of a bit generic and broad, and probably lots of people covered it before. But if you say like 7 underrated saving tips or 7 money tips the top 1% are using that you don't know. So like,
yeah,
I think there's nothing wrong. I think the actual format of list and listicles is really effective, and it's very easy to consume as well. But I think if it's a low number, so like between like 3 things and like 10 or 12 things, I want there to be a really unique thing. If it's a really big number, sometimes that can be just like a bit more generic because you're just getting so much in one video. So you see these videos which are like 40 pieces of life advice I learned before turning 40 or something. You see these like real quick fire, like life advice type videos. So, I mean, even I always think about listicles as well. If your listicle is like under 10, I think you can start to see it as less of just a listicle, but more of like a puzzle. So I actually used to look at my YouTube videos like that. I would say, I'm posing a question, how did this creator grow this fast? And my listicle is basically every video followed like the 3 steps. The people used to like joke about it. They're like, Paddy's 4-step formula, Paddy's genius strategy. And basically every video would follow a listicle format, but it was like a puzzle list. So you'd pieces of the puzzle together to give the full picture. So I would say, how did this creator grow? Let's say, how did Mr. Beast grow? And then I'd be like, all right, here are the different components that led to his growth. And in the structure of my video, I would connect those points together. So I'm like, the first thing he did was this, but without this other thing that we're going to talk about next, it wouldn't have made sense. So next we have this, and then we have this, and then we have this. And we're piecing together the full picture for viewers instead of it being like, how did Mr. Beast grow? Random tip. Because that's like a bit chaotic and hard to follow. So it's like building a story into a listicle I really like. But yeah, it's definitely a format that works.
I also think you can define who the list is for. I love this channel Speed right now. And he'll make a video like 7 cars for cool nerds.
Right.
And that's where like the tension and the interestingness comes from. Or like 7 cars for cool nerds under 25 grand or something like that.
So we're talking a lot about, you know, frameworks, pulling from what works on YouTube. And I think the challenge is nothing exists in a vacuum. So you do want to fit into the world of YouTube. You want to be familiar. You want to be unexpected. You want to make sure it's unique to you. But once you find something, it is pretty common that your category will just adopt your visual language. I think your thumbnails are a great example. I think our thumbnails are a great example. We are hard pressed to go on YouTube and see an interview that doesn't look kind of like our thumbnails. And especially in our niche, they look exactly like our thumbnails. They might have a slight change in, you know, color on the box that goes over the text, but you know, we screenshot a lot of thumbnails that look exactly like our thumbnails, and we recognize that it might be hard for our audience to even identify when it's a Colin and Smear thumbnail now, because we're not in the thumbnails. It's guest plus, you know, quote or guest plus name. So what do you think in the direction of, how do you advise channels to evolve from that when you found a format that works, you've built a brand off of it, but now you're living in a sea of sameness?
Mm. Yeah, that's a great question. It's a big decision, because what I think sometimes happens is you have come up with a format that's really successful and that works really well. Other people are copying it. And then almost like you get bullied out of the market by thinking you have to change.
Yeah.
Which is so funny, but I've talked to creators before. And I'm like, why did you change this thumbnail format? It was working so well. And they're like, everyone else in my niche started copying me. And it's like, but it never stopped working. So like you just kind of let like someone who had 10% market share bully you out of the niche, which I usually strive more towards just doubling down further. Like I didn't care how many people, like so many people took my thumbnail format.
The graph.
Like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And also I'm sure like if I trace back, there was some source, some place where I originally had that idea from. Like it wasn't a complete original thought as well, but it was my style. A lot of people copied it, but there was times where I got triggered. Like I'd see like, especially when there was one example where someone did the graph, their scripting was like identical to my scripting. And they even used like the same background music and the same like bridging sentences, like, but next up, like they said it the exact same way as me. I was like, this is ridiculous. But I think generally I advise people, unless the format is not working, don't stop. So like, if you're sort of thinking like, hey, our format has not stopped working just because other people are doing it, I wouldn't stop because of that. But I do think it's sometimes about like, what are little things we can bring into the thumbnail that identify it as ours? I think people's mind immediately goes to like, oh, a little logo in the bottom left.
Sure.
I don't love that.
Yeah.
It can sometimes work. I don't love it.
My mind always goes there.
Yeah.
And my mind is always like, please take it off.
And he always says, absolutely not. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't love that, because for everyone who hasn't seen you, which as big as you guys are, it's still like a huge audience that's never seen you before.
Of course, yeah.
They're going to kind of go like, oh, that's kind of ugly. Not that your dog is ugly, but they're going to like, that kind of breaks up the image and I don't know what that is. And it kind of just adds busyness that I don't like. So I always think of like thumbnail brand as more like, you know, could be color of text. I've seen a lot of people like copy your sort of yellow color, but it could be color of text. It could be font. It could be just like, sometimes I think about even the t-shirt or color that the guest is wearing. Like it's difficult to control, but maybe in the thumbnail edit, you can control it. But overall, I think it's just about trying to drown out that noise.
It's hard as a creative to drown out the noise.
Yeah.
It's like the creator brain is actually look at what's working and repeat what's working. The creative is how can I be unique? And sometimes those are at odds with each other.
Yeah.
Right. And it is the creative dies inside when you're no longer unique, when you live in a sea of sameness. But the creator, you're right. If it's working, you're just like, oh, okay, just keep doing that thing.
I think I took this from you guys. You said this on a podcast maybe years ago and it really resonated with me, where you said there's like artists and distributors.
Yeah, there's a spectrum of artists and distributors.
Like I can't tell you how much I think of that in my head and try to think and place where different people are on that frame. So maybe someone like Casey is really far on the artist side.
Yeah.
Maybe someone like Jimmy is more on the distributor side, you know? And it's interesting to think where we fall. Like I know that I fall probably further on the distributor side. There's part of me that has that creative inclination and wants to like always like be original and be fresh and come with completely new things. But there's another part of me, which is like, hey, like if we want to build something sustainable and build a business, it's like, if you're a band and you have a record that sells really well in a certain genre, and then you say, I want to be different and switch the genre altogether. You could be Kanye and it could work, or you could be all the other artists that like
fail. Wild artist call out. From Patty.
I guess if you're Kanye, it works until it doesn't work.
Yeah, not the best time.
actually, Frank Ocean is a really interesting example there too of like, so for people who don't know the spectrum that we're talking about, Colin and I talk about this spectrum of artist to distributor. The distributor is like the studio movie executive who's like, we got to make another Spider-Man because Spider-Man puts butts in seats. So keep making another Spider-Man. The artist is like, I'm going to make whatever I want. I don't care if people see it. And I think creators have to live like probably 75% towards distributor.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and I think I live somewhere in the middle which is challenging. Like the more you push over towards the artistic side, you might even have someone like an Emma Chamberlain who just like doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, just like, I don't want to play this game anymore. So it's an interesting middle ground between like strategy and creativity.
You know, what's something I find really helpful with this is, and it actually goes back to a point you brought up earlier in this conversation as well about like building almost like a bingeable format. So they watch one and they can watch another.
Right.
So I like to think of this framework that I call the 80% rule, but it's not like the classic Pareto principle 80% rule, which is like, we should aim to interest 80% plus of our audience with every upload. That sounds kind of basic when you hear it said, but it's a great way of diagnosing problems with the channel. Because you look at a channel and you see them doing all these different formats and you're like, you know, let's say you're playing this video game, then you're doing this video game, then this video game. And they all fall within the category of video games. So you can say, I'm in the video game niche, but like the percentage of people on planet Earth that play all three of those games is probably very, very small, you know? And it's the same, even like when we went into like a brand channel like Red Bull, like they have all these different sports. They have like skiing, snowboarding, basketball, Formula One. And like there's very few people on Earth, and most of them work at Red Bull, who actually enjoy and do all those things at the same time. So I always say the 80% strategy rule says you should try to aim 80% of your audience. But the second part of it is 80% of the time. So you try to aim to interest 80% plus overlap with your audience in every video. But you do that 80% of the time. So you get one in, let's say, every five videos that you can just try something different and go and break that rule. And I think that's where you kind of innovate. Because if you just, there are channels that just focus down on like milking a certain format so much that then when that format dries up, they don't really have a bridge to cross to go to another place. I will say from a strategy perspective, I'm always more in favor of milking something than under milking something. It's like someone's like, what if I milk this too much? It's like, well, what if you don't milk it too much and everyone else copies it and you've just wasted all these, you know, views.
The viewmaster is not going to tell you to stop.
No, that's for sure. No. There's a term in American football, which is run it till they stop you, which literally means run the play until they can, like run the ball until they stop it. Because like, if it's working, just keep doing it.
Yeah. For us, I mean, you talk about experimenting. We always say that like you should have an engine as a creator and you should also have room for experimentation. For us, the show is the engine. Like it's consistent for us. We can put it out on a regular basis. And then we've started to actually set goals of like, oh, you know what? We want to do one video a quarter that is a total experiment. And that way we can look back on the year with some structure to that to make sure we're doing both, you know, the engine that we know works and the experimenting to see like maybe what the future of the channel could look like.
Yeah. But can I ask you this? With that experiment, are you going to measure it against the success of your other videos, or are you going to view it in isolation?
That's a really good question.
Because this is the biggest thing I see as a problem with like even YouTube's ranking system, which a lot of people want to get rid of. I still like the ranking system personally, but you know, again, the view maximizer. I love anything that gives me data.
I definitely don't want to get rid of it.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think there's a quote from a movie executive who said, "The day I stopped caring about the box office numbers is the day I should be out of the business."
Yeah.
And I always feel that about the 1 of 10 ranking of like the day I stopped caring about that is the day I should be out, because that is, that's the game. Like that's the game we're playing. And if you don't care about that game, then you're not in it.
Yeah.
You know, and you might've fallen out of love with it. It is painful. It's a painful game, but it's you have to love it.
I think for us, it's a little bit difficult because I generally always know the experiments will work.
Sure.
Because they are documentary, long form, behind the scenes, with either Jimmy or Mark Rober or some big creator.
Ludwig,
and it's visual. Like it's made to be watched on TVs. It's made to be clicked on immediately. Whereas I know a 3-hour podcast episode is probably not going to have that initial velocity. Right. So I think for us, it's a little bit difficult.
Maybe that's a problem. Like maybe if you feel like all your experiments are, you already know they're going to work, maybe you should try something that you're like a bit more uncomfortable with. I think the interesting thing I always notice with creators, and it's just like, we're all like this, but someone's like, this is an experiment. It's an experiment. It's something new. We don't know how it's going to do, you know? And then they upload the video and it's an 8 out of 10 and they're like, disaster, change thumbnail, change thumbnail. What's happening? My channel is declining. Everything's gone down the drain. It's a rig. YouTube is rigged. It's a rigged game. You know? And it's like, guys, like we said, this was going to be an experiment. Like I have to deal with that. Yeah. Part of my job is working with creators who are emotional people. I'm an emotional person as well, but like, it's like calming them down and being like, we knew this was going to underperform, you know, which I know is not the most reassuring thing to say, but like, a thing, like a little hack that creators can do is before they upload a video, just get a Google Sheet, get a Notes app, and just give a prediction for where you think it's going to come out of 10. I call it like an expected outcome. Like, where do we think this video is going to fall? You have to like use a bit of your gut, bit of maybe previous data of how videos have performed before, but just give yourself an expected outcome. So when you upload the video, if you have in your note or your sheet that it's going to be probably around an 8 out of 10, and it's an 8 out of 10, it's performing as expected. It's not underperforming. But it's like, imagine a business launches a new product line, which is the equivalent of a YouTube video experiment, and compares it against their flagship product. They'd be like, this is performing terribly.
Why did we ever do this?
This is disastrous. But if they compare it to like a new product or how that product performed when it first came out, they might be like, actually, there's something here.
I think if it's a 5 out of 10, it's a big hit.
Yeah. You
know? Right. We have to look on such long time windows, but we're not able to.
Yeah.
Right. Because like, if that's an investment. A new format is an investment in the future. So I think we also have started to value anecdotal feedback, which is really intangible. But like, who reached out after we made that video? Who was in our inbox? Who DM'd us? Who, when we're out at an event, what episodes are they talking about? Right. Like last year, we made an episode about Hot Ones. And about like them going up for sale and kind of some of our predictions and our thoughts on it. It's not our biggest video ever, but it was the most talked about of the year, and it created the most conversation. And that's a metric that we really value. So of course, there's the classic metrics that go alongside those rules that we just talked about, where it's like, okay, did people click? That's, you know, click through rate. Did they have a high click through rate? Did people watch till the end? AVD. Did people watch another video? Right? Is there a returning viewer rate that we can connect to here? Those we're obviously tracking, but then there's the anecdotal brand feedback that I think some creators forget about. Like, we're building brands, and that metric comes from how the industry perceives you, or how your peers perceive you, or how the world perceives you. And I think brand perception is something that is incredibly important when you're building a media platform, or like a personal brand, or when you're now talking about blue chip, you know, major legacy brands like Red Bull. Views might not be just the only thing that matter there. It's going to also be like the perception of the Red Bull brand, right? And those are sometimes can be at odds with each other.
Yeah, like maybe me as the view maximizer for that 28 million view video. I'm like, look at this, look at the view count, look at the ranking, look at the lead it has over the 2 out of 10. Look at the retention curve for 28 million views to still hold this well. That's amazing. But the executive at Red Bull might be like, look at the top comment. It says, wow, only Red Bull would put off something this great. You know, because that's all the comments are like that. So sometimes the screenshots of the comments in that video is a great case study of why brands should be doing YouTube, because it's just like people, they don't just see that as Max Verstappen, drone, Formula One car. They see it as Red Bull. They're like, Red Bull did this for us. They brought this for us. And that's so much more valuable than 28 million ad impressions. Like, that is people living with your brand, living with your content. So I think what you've described is really important, but the difficult thing is I think it's so hard for people to measure.
Yeah.
So you're saying like you go to people, like people that come to an event, stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to measure. It's just like a feeling. Yeah, it's very hard to measure. There's no like corporate KPI against it. It's just like a feeling.
Yeah, you have to be careful to let that sway you too much depending on what the feedback is.
You could also just have a dude who's like, I love that. I mean, when we were first starting on YouTube, anyone who told us they loved that one video, we're like, let's make another one of those videos right now. Like that dude at the coffee shop said he liked it.
When I used to work with a quite large Minecraft channel, we had a Discord server with maybe like 200,000 or 300,000 like fans in this Discord server. And we had an individual channel, which was like contribute with video ideas. So imagine all these like people watching this Minecraft content, like your audience contributing with video ideas, and it would be like 50 or 60 a day. So like those build up, you're getting hundreds of video ideas per week. I don't believe we ever made one from that list of people. And that wasn't to dismiss our audience's feedback, but it was nearly always do this again. Or like, it was never actually like the signal. But one thing that's interesting on this, and maybe if there's like a YouTube employee watching, I've said this to you before, but like I would love this feature. We know that on YouTube, it's about clicks and it's about watches, but it's also about satisfaction. It's also about how satisfied you're making the viewers. And still today, I just feel like it's very difficult to measure that. You can look at like to dislike ratio. You can look at comment sentiments, but imagine we had a situation where like YouTube gave us like a satisfaction score for a video. That might be a really interesting way of measuring. I know with Twitter, how I measure satisfaction on Twitter, it's maybe not perfect, but I look at the bookmarks.
Yeah.
So I was like, how many people were like, I want to bookmark this. I've had tweets that have done 500,000 views that have 100 bookmarks. I have tweets that did 100,000 views that have 3,000 bookmarks, you know? Mm-hmm. So I like to look at like how many people are bookmarking on Twitter, but the YouTube equivalent of that is quite difficult. You could look at shares, you could look at likes. I just wish there was something in studio. Maybe it's impossible because they measure against so many variables, but I wish there was something that showed your video got a 78% satisfaction score or something. Mm-hmm. That would be amazing.
So if we talk about like the evolution of YouTube and the evolution of media, you just mentioned like that video from Red Bull, the comments are all about like this gift that Red Bull gave to the audience, right? And that essentially making a equivalent of a TV show. Like the Red Bull channel is like Red Bull TV, right? And I don't think I anticipated that when we first started YouTube. I kind of anticipated that maybe the individual could become the modern media platform. And that has played out, right? Like individuals are more trusted from a media perspective than major corporations, the NBCs of the world, the CNNs. Like they're not as trusted as the individuals who put out content on YouTube. But brands stepping in and becoming their own media platforms is interesting. And it's still not fully all the way there. We're at like very early stages with Red Bull probably leading the pack.
I mean, this conversation is so incredibly niche.
Yeah.
When you think about it, like some of the tips that we're throwing around, some of the verbiage that we're throwing around, like you'd be hard pressed to find people from a marketing department at a brand who truly like understand and
what we're talking about,
what we're talking about and why they would need this. But I do truly believe that like 5-10 years from now, they will be extremely well-versed or they will have someone who is well-versed.
Like, is Nike going to make their own show on YouTube? Is McDonald's going to have their own version of a show? You know, what does the future of brands look like? And I'm curious if you could speak to right now how you think creators and brands differ on YouTube. Yeah. And just your perspective, because you have a front row seat to how brands are treating YouTube. Like, if we play this out, like, what are they the next, like, big studios?
I mean, that's really interesting. I think creators and brands, like the biggest difference is most creators, not all creators, but most creators, when you really dig deep, they just want to grow their audience. Not always, but like, you know, if, especially if they're coming to someone like me to work, it's usually because they want to grow their viewership. Because if we grow their viewership, and like we have a great stat that we quote internally, but first 12 months of working with a channel, long form viewership growth is around 350 to 400% year over year. So the 12 months before we took over, the 12 months after, it's around 350 to 400%. And especially with big established channels, that's like a pretty big difference. For creators, great. That's what we want. You know, give us views. View maximizer, like grant us more views, right? The brands, it's like, we want views, we want to grow on views, but also we want to like be in front of the right viewers. We don't want to just get views for the sake of it. We also don't want to do anything that puts our brand at danger or in a bad light, you know? And those are things that like a traditional YouTube coded brain like mine, maybe I first go into a situation like Red Bull and I'm like, oh, like let's race an F1 car versus like Neymar, or let's like do all these like huge ambitious ideas. And some of it is like, that would get views, but that's not what we care about. You know, we don't care about views alone. Like we care about the connection. They want to grow the viewership, but they look at it as like, how can a lot of people see our brand in connection with, aligned with good content, and just feel like this brand brought this situation to us? So I think the biggest difference is they just optimize for more things, which actually makes it sometimes a bit more difficult. And that's what I learned from first working with, like Rebel was the first brand we work with. You know, we work with the Philadelphia Eagles now, the football team, the Super Bowl champions. We work with like a big car manufacturer, one of the biggest car manufacturers in the world, which I can't name, and like some other brands here and there as well. And like all of them have their own things. They're not just views. They want to like showcase this side of the business. They want to use it. I think some brands look at it as like almost a recruitment driver, like come work with us because this is how cool it is to like, you know, make content here or like work at these companies. So every brand is different. And that's like the biggest difference between creators is they're optimizing for so much more than just views. Hmm.
Do you ever have a brand that comes to you that you're working with and says, okay, we have a product launch video and I want to put it out on the channel?
Brand, you can see me shutting my eyes with frustration. Brand YouTube channels are corporate video dumping grounds.
Right. Yeah.
Like they just treat it as like, this is, oh, I have this place where I can put videos. Therefore, it's almost treated like a Vimeo. Like it's like, let's just host videos there that we can put on the website and stuff. So, you know, you can look at like any big company and even companies that you might think would be better at this. But like I was even looking at like a huge like cybersecurity company recently that's got like a $50 billion valuation or something. Go onto their channel and it's like all just like letter from the CEO or like launch video or like what we're doing to connect with. And it's just the corporate video, like dumping ground.
There's and you're trying basically to not be seen at that point.
Yeah.
Like with titles like that.
Yeah. It's the anti-YouTube strategy.
It's the anti-YouTube strategy.
The anti-YouTube strategy. We're like, yeah, you keep doing that. Keep making corporate videos. Just don't even think about title thumbnail. Just put like video one. Like,
Which actually might perform better, honestly. If you just call it like video one.mov.
It's mysterious.
Honestly, a black screen with video one would do better the way.
It's true. So many brands do that where you'll even go to their Instagram or their TikTok and it's really well programmed. It's well funded. They've thought it out. And then you go to their YouTube channel and it's like tumbleweeds. It's just like weird remnants of corporate videos.
You know what it is, in my opinion? I think a lot, this is just my opinion, is because for some reason, YouTube hasn't had as much commercialization in the B2B space, like with like people providing YouTube level service to brands, that like they will end up working with these big agencies, like the big traditional like social media agencies, marketing agencies, and they've got a pretty good dial on like Instagram, Facebook, you know, maybe not TikTok, but they've got a bit of a dial on it. So they can make content and it's relatively easy to make like decent Instagram content, decent TikTok content. YouTube, I think they still pay those same companies to do their YouTube. And I don't think those brands, agencies really have YouTube expertise in-house. Some of them do, I'm sure, but the majority don't.
You like firmly cannot consider YouTube in the same conversation as Instagram and TikTok. Yeah. Like I can't underscore that enough. I think like to do YouTube right is the first step, honestly, that I would do is have like a YouTube strategist, but like a writer who's like writing a format that makes sense for both your brand and the channel. Like I think about Shopify a lot. Shopify is like a very present brand in the YouTube ecosystem, but they still do a lot of like corporate uploads to Shopify, or, you know, they do tutorials and stuff like that. But I was watching this, this video, like there's a lot of videos that are like starting $1 million business in 24 hours. Right. Like that could be a format that Shopify produces on their channel. Right. And like that could be a show that's just repeating. I mean, like a ton of people would watch that.
There's a creator, I think, called Starter Story. Have you ever seen that creator?
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
And he does like how this guy like started a business in his living room, how this guy makes $3 million a year from faceless YouTube channels, right? These different things. I think you're so right. Shopify could be making every one of those videos. They have like the database of all these interesting people.
Totally.
They create like a existing, all they need is really like a format, a title, and a thumbnail. And they could be printing views for their
channel. I think about the same thing with car companies. It's amazing. I know you're working with one, but it's amazing to me when I look at the YouTube channel for a major car company and it's corporate uploads and releases of certain cars and things, tutorials, because there is such an unbelievable ecosystem of car videos on YouTube that don't rely on like a big name being in the car. Like the car and the journey the car goes on is the star of the title thumbnail. And it's so easy, I feel like, for car companies to be a part of that.
Something crazy. So a car is like the second biggest purchase decision you make in your life, right? After a house, usually, for most people. I'd say the average car price in America is 25 to 40K, probably. When people are buying a car, there's research that shows that the platform that they go to for research of what to buy is YouTube.
Yeah.
More than anything else, more than ads, more than like magazines, more than newspapers. So like people are going to YouTube videos to make this purchase decision, which is like, $30,000 for a YouTube video. Like we're not just selling fidget spinners. we're selling cars for $30,000.
Which is why Doug DeMauro has the business that he does.
So it's crazy that like the interesting thing is earlier we talked about competitive advantages. Well, what's a competitive advantage for like these big brands is like when they're releasing a new product, they have access to it before anyone else. So why aren't they doing the first video revealing it? Why is like an influencer, a creator? And I don't want to take these views away from creators too, because I think it can benefit the whole space if brands do this, but like the brand themselves should be first.
But if you also like, so if we just take a step back on this concept of like brands becoming producers of content, Apple is a great example, right? Like when I first bought my, you know, my first ever Mac computer or iPod, did I think that Apple was going to make something like Severance? No, right? Like Severance is one of the greatest TV shows and it's funded by a company that is not necessarily an entertainment company. They're an entertainment company that's funded by a different product. Yeah. Amazon Prime Video is another great example, right? We're already seeing it where producers of content are rooted in a different type of business. And I think that's going to play out on YouTube pretty significantly, where it's like, hey, we have the funds. We could probably engage our audience better if we make a show. But I think the misguided understanding of YouTube is that it's a like like your YouTube channel is a place to upload videos. But if you think about your YouTube channel as a show, it feels really different. And that's where like that third rule that we talk about of, do you want more stuff like this? It's like, if something hits, think about, like, respect the audience to go, their expectation is that this is a show. Yeah. Like Amelia de Moldenberg's channel is Chicken Shop Date, right? The kind of like network model of a channel, or like a channel being like a ton of different things, I don't think really works as well as it used to. There was a time in YouTube where that did work,
yeah,
where BuzzFeed could upload 10 different shows and they'd all kind of hit. But I don't think that works anymore. Like when BuzzFeed was hitting with that show Worth It, right? That was a format. It's like, or the Try Guys, all those shows had to spin off to their own channels because they couldn't live in this environment anymore. And I think brands should look at that and go, wait, we can't upload like a ton of different things. We're actually just looking to make one show, a hit show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a show that will compete with other shows in the genre.
Yes.
Not just like a hit show.
Right.
For hit show's sake, a show that will be directly pegged and placed next to all of your competitors.
Now, I think this is a really interesting time because I think that independent creators will likely, like there's enough amazing creators who understand YouTube and the internet now. But I think of that subset, there's a lot of them that don't want to do the advertising business. Meaning the independent advertising business of selling brand sponsorships, themselves, right? Managing their own. But if they got hired as like a show creator for a brand that they're interested in, things change, right? Like if you're a cooking creator and all of a sudden, you know, Le Creuset comes to you and is like, you know what? We love what you're doing. Can we just kind of like acquire you into this and you're our, like make this cooking show, but make it through the context of Le Creuset.
That's really interesting. And especially creators that are maybe like, they've hit a point with their channel where they want a new challenge. Maybe they're a bit burnt out and they're doing a lot themselves. A big brand is like, hey, like, come develop this show internally with us. And like, we'll give you everything. We'll make sure like you, you know, don't have to do all the editing, all that kind of stuff. I could see that.
And if you think about a brand like Target, so Target has a YouTube channel, right? And we talked about this a bit before we recorded.
I don't want to look at it. Is it good?
It's not good. No, it's not good. And Target's a massive brand. And you think about this context of Target, it's like, how does Target not have Supermarket Sweep as a show? How do they not do it? The thumbnail's right there. The like, you know, whatever you can put in the cart, you know, you take is such a clean format. It's very easy.
Let alone they have so many creators now who have products in Target.
That
they could integrate into the episodes.
Have you seen, there's a channel called The Deal Guy?
No.
Have you seen that channel?
Uh-uh.
They just do, I think it's Costco. He just does like a monthly roundup of like Costco. And it's like, what's a great deal in Costco this month and whatnot.
That's so good.
Like, why doesn't that, why doesn't a big shopping brand do that?
I'm going to tell you guys the most recent upload to the Target YouTube channel.
Great.
It is titled, the title's too long, so it doesn't fit. So let me open the video. It's titled, Target Accelerators Presents, semicolon, Retail Fundamentals, - Introduction to Mass Retail. 634 views in 9 days. And the thumbnail looks like a Zoom call. Look at that.
Whoa.
Like, that is just such...
This is why I said I didn't want to see it.
That is crazy. It's just such a massive missed opportunity for the amount of access that Target has.
Yeah.
And how commonplace a Target is to everyone in the US. And so already accepted and comfortable. It's an amazing set for a show.
Dude, I mean...
video, whatever this video is about, Target Accelerators Presents Retail Fundamentals.
I have no idea.
I'll tell you what, like, it doesn't need to live here.
But you know what's interesting?
Put it on Vimeo. It can live somewhere else. Because clearly...
Because who's watching that?
Because like, no one's waiting for it.
Are they just making videos for their own like senior employees to look at?
There's a question of like brand risk with these brands. And to me, this is riskier than what we're talking about. Like, what was Jimmy's format? It was like, anything you can put in the cart, I'll pay for, right? Something like that. If Target repeated that format with celebrities, with also with just regular people, it's fascinating. Right?
Yeah.
You showed up and it's like, here's a Target cart. Anything you can fit in the cart in the next 30 seconds, you keep. People choose interesting things. Like, I would watch that all the time. You get short form content out of that. Like, I think if you think about your channel as a TV show, all of a sudden it can change the framework in people's minds, because you'd be like, why would we upload that Zoom call to our TV show? That's crazy.
What you just said there, I think that's going to resonate a lot with brands. Like, that just like change it to, would you do this if it was like a TV show?
Because I would love to sit with brands in this context, because I think brands have recognition, they have funding, and they, a lot of them have like sets. Like we're talking about Target, like they have a set for this show.
And they have production teams. And the
production teams.
And the people in those production teams, I would imagine a lot of them are pushing with what we're saying right now.
Yeah.
Like they're really like, guys, and like you said, the brand risk, like the, you know, the brand sort of like excuse might be like, oh, it's like risky. We don't want to try it. Like it could go wrong, which I understand. But like we just started this podcast talking about how YouTube is Hollywood. It's streaming. It's podcast. It is the platform. And in 3 or 4 years, I feel like consumers are going to like kind of look at brands and be like, what are they doing on YouTube? And if you look at Target, and they, I can't even remember the title, it was so long, but like accelerator, core, fundamental, whatever. Yeah. Like if you look at that, it's embarrassing, in my opinion, to like represent like such a big, impressive brand with like that content.
But I wonder if it'll just naturally again play out with like brands just picking up creators.
Yeah.
It could happen. Yeah. It could be really,
I mean,
really,
if you search Target haul, there are so many videos of like self-care haul at Target in the last year that have 2.8 million views.
Right.
Right. Upwards of 3 to 4 to 5 million views.
But how does it happen that there's not somebody who does a quick audit of like, let's search, or like in your experience, is that what we're seeing there? That's just a deprioritization of YouTube and Target being like, maybe, hey, there's, like you're saying, there's Target hauls all over YouTube. We're already essentially present on YouTube. Why would we have to have our own show?
I think it's just maybe not even understanding like the discoverability of YouTube. Mm. Like, because if they did that Target haul show, they brought in like some celebrities to do it. Like, I don't think it's outrageous to say they could be reaching 10 million viewers an episode.
But the danger is that they might overproduce it.
That's the question I wanted to ask both of you actually, is how do you keep it authentic? Because sometimes if you even if you bring a creator who's great onto a brand channel, you can tell there's so many bigger forces at play that it doesn't feel authentic. And that's also a huge risk, I think, if you're going to have a brand YouTube channel.
Yeah, true.
They need to have that creator in the room. They need to have people like us in the room. They need to have people that can direct and have actual ownership of that. Because in my experience, and I think I'm very lucky because I work with, you know, the Red Bull team, and their YouTube team is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So even before I came in, like they're already doing pretty decent content, and like we've skyrocketed it with them, but like a lot of that's down to them and how talented their individuals are. And even higher level in the company, like their higher executives are really open to content. They understand how important content is. Then we work with, you know, like the Eagles, and like my connects with the Eagles, like the person I directly report to at the Eagles, like he just sees, he watches YouTube, he sees how valuable YouTube is. But I think the problem is that, like, to your point, like maybe you could bring in a creator to make this show format, but like if all these maybe senior marketing people who are like really good at their traditional marketing roles, obviously, but if they start to like pull it around and say like, no, that doesn't look polished enough, or we need to do this, 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 it ends up looking too corporate. And a bit of a tangent, but like an example of this is like, you know, the Ronaldo channel?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When it launched, like I was like, oh, awesome. Ronaldo's doing a channel, like most famous athlete in history. Like this is going to be huge. And it's obviously done really well. But I watched that content.
We said that it broke all the rules.
It broke every rule. About
I was like, this is like a great way of putting it is like, this is what people think that have never watched YouTube before think YouTube is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you've never actually sat down and consumed content, you would say, oh, like they want like these funny, like weird edits and like laughing soundtracks. Yeah. And like, it's just like, it's almost a parody of what YouTube content is.
Yeah. And it's like an SNL skit of YouTube. And then there's also like bizarre things like the iPhone videos of him playing tennis with his kids, and it's like a 12-second clip that like repeats and does like different star transition and all this stuff, and it has like 60 million views.
Yeah, it's like if he's doing that with that, imagine.
But that he's like that's a unicorn.
Yeah,
you know, that's a unicorn. It's like I think actually celebrity channels are at heavy risk of overproduction, heavy risk. Mm. Like the excitement is actually the intimacy, and I think you mentioned access. Access is like, you know, Chris Hemsworth or something going to like a sick gym is like, I've seen it a million times. I don't, it doesn't, unless Chris Hemsworth says something exclusive or there's something exceptionally interesting, it doesn't, I've seen it too many times at this point.
Yeah.
So to explore the three questions we try and ask anyone who asks us YouTube advice or even honestly product advice, the first three questions are, who is this for? Why would they watch? And is it unique to you? And I think those are just three really simple questions to always ask. And the second one I think gets overlooked quite a bit of like, why would they watch this? Right. And I think the assumption is because it looks pretty.
Yeah. And I think with celebrity, YouTube channel specifically, the assumption is they'll watch because I'm a celebrity.
Because I'm a celebrity, yeah.
But it's not concepted or titled and thumbnailed correctly to actually reach people.
So that's like interesting. I think a lot of celebrities do like almost like vlogs.
Right.
They're just like 24 hours with me in Miami or something.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, like I guess your big core fan base would like this, but if you're really viewing content as a way to actually broaden your empire and improve your distribution, like I like the idea of like concept vlogs. So not just a vlog, but a, like there's a concept behind what you're doing.
Totally.
So it's like, instead of just like 24 hours me, it's like day in the life of like an NFL player or something. It's like, okay, that's a concept now.
Which is something you basically did with the Eagles, right?
Yeah, the Eagles did a video a year and a bit ago that we helped them package that was 7 days, an NFL player's life for 7 days with Lane Johnson, who's one of their star players. And I feel like if you just titled that like maybe more specific to the player or more specific to the Eagles, it would have performed a lot less than it did.
Is Lane Johnson's name in the title?
I don't believe it is. I don't think it's, at least not at the start. I think it's I think it's NFL player to give it that broader appeal. So it's not just the Lane Johnson fan.
Which
it's
is like, probably hard for people to wrap their heads around, especially like if you're at the Eagles, you're like, it's Lane Johnson.
Yeah, he's the guy.
They're like, why are you calling him NFL player?
I do that a lot with the Eagles. I'm like, unless it's like Saquon or Jalen, like NFL player.
Yeah.
You know, which maybe some people would look at as like, these are huge names, but it's like to that broad audience. Same with like a Red Bull. Like there's a Max Verstappen, there's a Neymar, who these are Red Bull athletes. There's all these other athletes that are all really, really important and like are incredible in their fields, but like, do they have like audience recognition? Do people, I sort of think it as like zeitgeist names. Like people see Max Verstappen, they're like, okay, I know that guy drives cars fast. So if I see a video of him driving against a drone, makes sense, right? But a lot of people like overestimate how important people are or like how interested people are in people's names. I see this all the time, even with like business channels. A channel like a podcast channel that did this would be like Diary of a CEO. So instead of, he could pick this person who's like a huge, like well-known figure, but he'll call them like the money expert.
Yeah.
Like, and we've done this too.
Good health expert.
As someone who has a similar type of show, it is weird to look at a guest and be like, do we use their name or do we use a description of who they are? You know, specifically with Jacob Collier, who's this Grammy winning musician, like multi times winning musician. We had him on the show and we titled it, we interviewed the Mozart of Gen Z, and his name's in the thumbnail. But that descriptor, I think, is why that episode found as much scale as it did. It's a great episode, but I think it's one of our my favorite episodes. But had we titled it around just Jacob Collier, I'm not sure we would have gone outside of his audience.
I mean, I think we're going to have a bit of a case with this episode, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think if you title this episode with my name leading, it could work well for your core audience. There's podcasts with my name leading that have maybe 100,000 views, maybe 200,000 views. But if you're going after a bigger view count, you're probably going to have to call me something else. You're going to describe me something different and I won't take any offense.
Yeah, and but that's the interesting part. I think what you mentioned is like, again, we're building a brand and there's sensitivities at play. And so I imagine also with the Eagles, like it might be really sensitive to not use Lane Johnson's name, because he might be like, whoa, why put my name in the title? Like, what are you talking about? Right. And I think you understand it. So we can actually have a very honest upfront conversation about like title and packaging for this video. I think the takeaway is like, whether you're a brand or you're a creator and you're trying to get better at this, like writing titles as a daily exercise is probably the most important thing you could do. Like it is just the whole thing. Thinking of titles, writing them, taking a title that you see on YouTube and reshaping it 100 times, you know, or just like, and now there's so many great tools to help you do that too, but just like getting a high volume of titles through your brain is so important, because then you can pull from formats that you have, right?
I sometimes tell creators like, write 30 titles for your video. And they're like, Patty, that's overwhelming. It's too much. I'm like, is everyone just experiencing things different to me? Because 30 titles, like we can write 30 titles and like, we could do that together in like 10 minutes,
right?
Not even. Like, it doesn't mean, I think people always think that when we say like come up with a huge volume of titles or thumbnail concepts, that they all have to be like great. No, like it's about like putting things together, trying different words, seeing what looks interesting, studying other people, like what are they doing, trying to adapt that. So for a lot of the clients we work with, like we're sitting down and me and my team will write 30, 40 titles for a video. And like, that doesn't take that long.
And five of them are slight alterations of a previous one, right? That's just like one word difference or something. So it's not like you're coming up with 30 brand new ideas in a row. You're writing one and then altering that and then altering it and altering it and altering it. And like you said, actually, if 29 of them are awful, that's actually totally fine.
because you'll also start to learn what a bad idea looks like, right? And like that's also important.
Exactly. Well, yeah. One other thing I'd say on brands as well is I've noticed about brands is like, I think this is just in my experience. I'd be curious, like with your work with brands as well, if you've noticed this, but quite often the brands are almost like, how do we let creators know that like we're open to collaborate or open to do things? I've heard that before. It's like, how do we like, because I think sometimes creators just assume, because some brands are so protective, like you maybe go to like some sports franchises and they're like, no, we're not going to give you access to this. No, whatever. But like, I know with the Eagles, like if you're a large creator and you have like a cool idea that involves like an NFL team, like, and they can give you some access or something, they're really open to being pitched on that sort of stuff. And the same for Red Bull. Like if you're a creator that has like an already pretty decent audience and you have like a cool idea with something with Red Bull, like they're pretty open. So the brands that are already doing YouTube as well, already almost like want to be like, guys, like tell us like ideas you want to make with us. Like we want to almost be part of this conversation and this eco space.
I think you need social proof first. So I think the Eagles have to do something with a creator. They have to go outbound first.
Yeah.
Right. So they actually have to pitch a creator an idea, do that, and then use that as the top of funnel. Because like as creators, as anyone in business, like social proof is so important. You got to be like, well, has anyone done it before? Right. What do you mean?
I also think for brands though, it can be overwhelming because there are so many creators. Like curation is what they need the most sometimes if they're going to work with a creator, someone to be able to say, hey, this is actually a vetted creator safe who's creator. Been in market for a while. They have an audience fit. Like they've worked with these brands in the past. This will be a great fit for you.
It's something that I'd say a lot of brands come to us with and that we do with a lot of brands is creator discovery. Just like, hey, just who should I even consider? Right? I think that's a really important process of like, what is that look and feel like? But back to what we were talking about when it comes to repeatable formats, Target has that supermarket sweep format. The ask is way clearer. The ask of like, pitch us anything feels overwhelming, right? You're putting a lot of onus on me as the creator to pitch you the Eagles something. But if the Eagles were like, hey, we do this format where you come, you answer five questions, like, will you come do it?
And it creates aspiration too. Of like, now I want to be on the Eagles show or I want to be on Target's show.
And I think like Condé Nast, actually, if we take a step further back, Condé Nast has created some of the most easy to repeat formats on YouTube. 10 things you can't live without, right? Or Architectural Digest. Or the 70, what was it, 73 questions?
72. Vogue. 72 or 73?
73? 73 sounds weirder. No. I think it's, guys, we can look this up right now.
No, let's let everyone put it in the comments.
Let's not look it up.
73.
Everyone put it up.
Yeah, I'm saying 72.
Yeah. But that all, you know, stems from, I'm not remembering his name. This one guy at Condé Nast who like really came up with a lot of these awesome formats. And I think when you have that format, like Colin said, it creates aspiration, right? Yeah. Like like 10 things I can't live without, the GQ thing. Like if we ended up on that, I'd be like, oh my God, we kind of made it.
Or like the wired autocomplete,
right? And so just look at what Condé Nast did and think about that in the context of your brand. Can you make one of those formats? Because now you can invite creators to come collaborate. And I think that's way easier than going, like, we're the Eagles, do something with us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then if you do have like a product launch or a campaign initiative, you can kind of just integrate it into your show that already does well.
Right. Yeah, it's so powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have full control over it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we will see this, but it's going to require a lot of hand holding because it's terrifying. It's terrifying for a brand to like make a show. Right. But I do think it is like that. It is absolutely the future. I want to talk about, we talked a lot about packaging. I'm curious how much you spend on the first 30 seconds of videos with your clients.
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about, we talked about earlier with the multiplier, I think the biggest levers to like multiply growth are that title, the thumbnail, the idea. Like it's rarely that a better intro leads to 270 times more views. But with that said, even with a video, I kind of break it down to like, what are the areas that are worth heavy time allocation? And like, if you take a 10 minute video, if you say 10 minute videos, well, how long do you spend on each minute? I think conventionally you would say, you're probably gonna spend like 10% of time on each minute in a 10 minute video. But for our clients and for how we think about things, like the allocation for that first minute might actually be 20 or 30%. It just might be a bit more allocation to really just like spend time on getting that right and front loading the video with the best value. One actually thing I really experienced and learned from our good friend, Jimmy, Mr. Beast, was like, when I was working with Jimmy 4 or 5 years ago, it was so interesting that how, like, when myself and the lead editor would bring the edit to Jimmy, if the first 30 seconds was great, like, he would like find all the rest of the content great as well. Not always, but he'd be much more happy with like how the video feels. But if something was wrong there, it was like, no, this is like
the whole thing's off.
Everything's off. Everything's wrong. And at the time I was like, I wonder why he thinks that. And the more I've like learned and experienced myself, it's like, well, Jimmy's coded his brain to like be a viewer. And if you start your video on the wrong foot, the viewer already has this, like, you've almost like anchored the video in bad. So the viewer's like, oh, this is already underwhelming, or this is already like not interesting. So they give you less leeway as you go along in the video. Mm. So I really like to think about, you know, intros. Like I always say, like my intro formula is like immediately try to deliver on the promise in some sense. So like if you make a promise in your title thumbnail, in your intro, can you deliver on that visually or verbally? Some way to just make like a nice frame I like to think about is like, just make your viewer feel like they made the right decision. Don't make them feel like an idiot.
You said the same thing.
Make them feel like they made the right decision. And then it's like, you know, the necessary context, not over context. So some creators put too much context in that intro. So what's the necessary context? What are the intriguing like parts of the story or parts of the video that you can kind of tease or highlight in that intro? And then how do we just kind of flow into the first storyline, the first action point without like this big gap? Like I like being able to look at an intro and say, I don't really know where that intro starts and ends. It just flows into the content. Other people have different ways of doing intro.
Yeah, that's interesting. We have a bit of a different framework for that.
Yeah.
Basically how we think about it is like the first thing is confirm the click. So you click in, you have to go, okay, that is the thumbnail that I clicked on. The first 7 seconds is establishing the video and kind of laying the context and the foundation for it. And by 30 seconds, we want to introduce a new hook. So we want to introduce something that you didn't expect from the thumbnail that is going to make you stay until the end.
And deliver an expectation of value.
Yeah.
If you stay towards the end, you will get these loops closed.
Right.
I like that.
So I think that's something that we try and do.
Yeah.
And explore. Yeah.
You can see all these different like formats for intros. Like a format I think is really successful as well and works really well is like multiple questions and then a promise of an answer. So it could be like, you could make, let's just think of an example. Like you're saying, so a megalodon, which is like a giant prehistoric shark. So you might say like the megalodon was like the fiercest predator in the oceans. It was like 5 times the size of a great white shark. It killed everything it saw on sight. And yet somehow it went extinct. How could this shark go extinct? Exactly. How could this thing happen? And then you sort of, the viewer like, how could that happen? And then you're like, is there a mysterious reason behind the disappearance of the megalodon? And then suddenly you're like, okay, that's intriguing. And then it's like, in this video, we're going to dive into
It reminds me so much of watching your old videos.
Yeah, totally.
Like the way that you talk, the way that you pose questions.
Yeah. That's my format, really.
It's Which begs the question for me, why don't you ever just make a channel that's faceless about something like that, that has like this massive audience just to see?
Well, the answer is I have.
Okay.
I've had a lot of faceless channels over the years. It's kind of like people think of me as just my Paddy Galloway channel, but I've had quite a few other successful channels over the years that have been faceless behind the scenes that I don't always reveal. Some of them being in kind of music genre that some people watching might have heard me talk about or hear before. But like the reason I love to work with creators is because I'm not that talented at being in front of camera. I just don't, maybe you disagree, but I don't think I'm that talented at being in front of camera. So I kind of realized early in my career, hey, like I'm good at these things, but a Minecraft creator is making videos that could get 20, 30 million views if they're right. So if I equip my knowledge and expertise with someone who has like the talent and the ability and maybe the competitive advantage, I don't have competitive advantage as a Minecraft player. Like I'm not good at Minecraft, but someone who's like really good at building, the world's best Minecraft builder or the world's best Minecraft PvP player, they might have this really big competitive advantage. So I look at it as like, I rather equip my skill set with like a bigger vehicle that can go further than my own vehicle. But I will say like, I think a natural evolution as I build out my company and team is I think we're gonna invest a bit more into original content. Hmm. And like, even with the creators work with now, I'm like thinking, how can we like have more ownership in the content? So it's not just like consultants, but it's partners, growth partners with channels.
Oh, that's cool.
Hmm. Yeah.
Cool. I like that. Do you consult on short form too? What's your position on, because there's kind of this world right now where YouTube is watched on TVs. There's content that's living in the like 22, 30, like if you look at Ryan Trahan's channel right now, like he's living in the like 30 plus range a lot. Yeah. Jimmy's living in the 30 plus range a lot, right? Like we're starting to see YouTube videos push 30, 40 minutes, or Michelle Carre putting out an hour long piece of content. And then the other side of YouTube is like super short form.
Yeah.
Weirdly, Red Bull is actually living in the middle.
Yeah. We crush it with short form there. But I would say, like, classically, like, I'm a long form guy. Like, that's always been what I've made. That's like I was a full time YouTuber between the ages of like 14 to like 22, 23. And kind of to present at different points. Like, that was how I made my living. And it was always through long form. So, like, that's what I feel like I'm best at. And I actually think other people who have come up over the last like 3 years might be better than me at doing short form. So what we do is, like, if brands want to do short form, like, we'll advise. We actually do ideation for some short form. We give some brands like ideas, because they're actually really fun. There's a lot of ideas that we brainstorm. We almost have like an elimination criteria. And some of those ideas, like, one of the elimination criteria is like, is this a short form idea? Because maybe it's a great idea, but does it live in like a 10 minute, 20 minute video? Maybe not, but maybe it lives really well in like a 20, 30 second short. So we do a little bit of that with clients. We don't lead with that. I think shorts is like amazing. I know a lot of people are kind of anti shorts or think it's bad, but like, I think it's really cool. And, you know, there is also a funny thing with like shorts inflation of like view counts and numbers, though, where, like, you know, even earlier in this episode, like, we quoted that, like, 10 billion views a year. Like, if I wanted to make it 100 billion views a year, I'd just try to like sign every massive shorts creator. So it is like a bit of a
that
crazy
gets back
thing.
Though to the like brand and impact and how it's tougher to measure, but making sure you're not just getting views for views sake. There's some actual engagement here. People are remembering your brand.
And I think there's also the question now of like all these other factors as we like continue to go into YouTube. Like, there's the creators who are most likely view maxing, right? With looking at Patty and being like, how do I view max? And then as we get into this more nuanced world of brands and celebrities, like, one person I think about and that we talked about before is Timothée Chalamet. Like, Chalamet, how he shows up on YouTube is really interesting to me, because he's like a movie star. And a movie star, if you think about, there was a time early on when Colin and I were working in sports where we worked with Jeremy Lin on his YouTube channel. Do you know who Jeremy Lin is? He's a basketball player who was probably the first NBA player to feel like very human. He's very relatable. He was...
But during his run as like Lin Sanity, superhuman at first, because he had just like an unbelievable run at Madison Square Garden and was not like a starting player, but he just like performed to an unbelievable degree for a number of games. But then after that, launched a YouTube channel with sketches and just very authentic, raw,
like, raw YouTube. Like, truly the first athlete I've ever seen to just go, I'm a YouTuber. And as we were working on that channel and being with him behind the scenes and like exploring what he was doing, I was like, this is so interesting, because with athletes specifically, there's this difference of humanizing an athlete and then also making an athlete essentially untouchable, right? So like, you go Michael Jordan in his heyday, that was like superhero, right? So you actually don't want a lot of Michael Jordan. You know, if you look back on it, like, I wouldn't advise someone like Michael Jordan to have a YouTube channel. I'd be like, don't be accessible, be inaccessible and be a superstar. And then you have Jeremy Lin, like the humanization. So all this comes back to the premise of a movie star like Timothée Chalamet, who actually, I don't know if people know this, has early origins on YouTube, did Xbox controller modifications on YouTube. And now his modern day press circuit was on YouTube. And that is the modern day press circuit. But I'm curious just to think about, like, can someone like that come onto YouTube, upload less, but still have a premium brand?
Should Timothée Chalamet have a YouTube channel?
So I think that's interesting, because like, movie stars, like, their life is very, like, I've never been a movie star, but I would assume it's like work like all day on a project for months and then like a bit of a break between projects, you know? So I even heard like Timothée talk about that, like how on like the set of the Bob Dylan movie, he was just like every day, every hour, just on it, on it, on it. So like, in that mode, having a camera following around or him trying to shoot content, you could see that being challenging and not work. But in those times in between, especially when we consider, like, I think he's like, he's a YouTube kid. Like, I think he's the same age as me, like very close in age to me. He probably grew up with YouTube. Like, when YouTube was released, I was like 10 or nine, and he probably grew up like, you know, the Xbox controller stuff, like the Call of Duty trick shotting. So he probably has a deep passion for YouTube. I think what we would do if us three were advising Timothée Chalamet is say, like, okay, like, what's really unique and interesting about your life that you can show? Probably a lot. Like, is it like a behind the scenes at the Oscars? Is it like a, you know, a recap? We talk about vlogs like failing a little bit sometimes, but a concept vlog about like getting access like night at the Oscars could be interesting. Also, like something I see, and it goes back to that NFL player thing, is with a lot of these big people, the interest is people wanting to know what it's like to be that person. So like the reason people like NFL player day in their lives is not always about the NFL player. It's about like, what does like an NFL player live like?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Especially people that see that as aspirations. Like, I'd love to be an NFL player. Like, how do they live? Like, what's this like? So I think about that for Timothy. Like, what are like the day in the life of like on the set of Dune 3 or something?
We always used to ask athletes, like, what would you talk about if you weren't being paid and if you couldn't talk about your sport? Like, is there anything that you would want to talk about, you'd be passionate enough to talk about, even if you didn't get paid for the rest of your life? And start there. Like, if it is your sport, fine. You can retire and you can still make videos about your sport forever. But is there something that you'd be interested in that's not? And I think with Timothy Chalamet, like, I would want to ask him too, like, instead of covering your life and giving access all the time, which will make you accessible.
And you might burn out from
that. Is there anything you are passionate about that you're a community member of that you would want to contribute to that community?
That's a really good idea. That's a good idea if we if you took down a celebrity and asked those things, but then like stop that one. Because I think that would be another issue. Is like, like people are so multifaceted that he's like, I like this, this, and this. And then before you know it, it's like,
it would have to be one.
Too much. Yeah. And I think because the people on the other side would be like, yeah, whatever you want. Cool. Yeah. Let's do all that.
Yeah.
I think with Chalamet, if he was, if he wanted to do this, I would be very curious about his fashion choices. Like, I would be very, very curious to watch how he thinks about that. Or if that's not something that he thinks about and a stylist does it, that's fine. But I think even what he wore to the Oscars was like unique and interesting. And he is like expressing himself in a really interesting way.
Or like, so, as a Knicks fan, do you want to do Knicks commentary?
Oh, that'd be super interesting.
Right? Like, how interesting would it be that like you kind of would have to watch, not because you're a Timothy Chalamet fan, but because you're a Knicks fan.
That
that would make him like such a multifaceted, he already is multifaceted, but like, I think it makes you that multifaceted person.
Yeah. But I also think you have to play the world of like accessibility, right? Of like, does it make sense to be accessible?
Which maybe doesn't work for him.
Which maybe doesn't work. But you go to another movie star who maybe wants to be accessible and you go, all right, yeah, maybe there is something here.
And I think it makes it's interesting how it ties into like the seasons of a career. Cause I think like movie stars, like, I guess they kind of, maybe they have like, some movie stars are just timeless, like a De Niro, a Al Pacino, you know, but like some movie stars, like they have like maybe a peak where they're like making all the big films. And then after that, they want to like take it a bit slower. And with athletes, there's like that cutoff point as well. Like if you're an NFL player and you're 35, you know, you're like, okay, realistically after this, I can either go into coaching, punditry, or I guess just live off my savings, you know, and do whatever. But maybe another avenue of that is content creator. Like I already have the base.
People
already like me for a reason. Can I just like, you know, I saw like Jason Kelsey did a video where he's like talking about his like custom car or something. A channel be that's just like Jason Kelsey talking about his car.
Yeah. I think what we tried to do with athletes at that time, and what I try and do with everyone who pitches me like a YouTube channel or format, I always say, think about this on a 52-week window. Can you make this every week for 52 weeks? At, like, cause sometimes like we also worked with Giannis. And
you want to say his last name?
Antetokounmbo.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I had to be able to nail it. So
I was trying to get
Giannis
you there.
Antetokounmbo.
We've done some videos with him with Jesser, and every time I'm like trying to read out, like, because that one of the videos with him did incredible. So every time I'm trying to read out the title, I'm like, and our video with Giannis, did really well.
No, I'm actually really impressed with him now. And I think the way he shows up in Jesser's videos are fantastic. I think that format, by the way, of Guess the NBA, Secret NBA Players, unbelievable format.
Yeah.
But like his rookie year, he was not that into doing the YouTube channel. I think he wanted to do YouTube, but he didn't have the time and space for it. So it was overproduced, too many people on set. I was looking around on the first day of shoot and I was like, if we want to do this every week for 52 weeks, this is going to be super expensive, unsustainable. It's like a massive production every week. And so you try and reduce it down. Again, you look at someone like Ryan Trahan filming with his iPhone. You're like, how can we get this into like the simplest form? Is it like Jason Kelsey with this, like Marquez's channel, Autofocus is perfect YouTube to me. It is perfect YouTube. That is like from a production lift perspective, he's holding his iPhone. He films with his car. Sometimes he barely cuts. It's like two cuts. He just rattles it off. and that's it. And it uploads. And he has like a thumbnail format for it. Like that to me is perfect YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. I love that channel. Have you seen the new intro format they've been doing where they like start in a bush or something and like creep out of the bush? And yeah, like it's intimidating to an athlete to be like title, thumbnail, intro, scripting, blah, 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 intriguing language, statement plus intrigue, you get asked quite all this stuff to be like, hey, what's something you're passionate about? You know, can you film with an iPhone? Can you go like that?
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Okay. One more brand channel I want to pitch is like if a airline like a Delta or something, or maybe like a more international one, partnered with or had a creator like a Drew Binsky and essentially just traveled to the destinations and did like simple formats of like living, if they're a more budget airline, you know, visiting Singapore on a dollar or like, you know, what can a dollar get you in Singapore, right? And they like use the airline to fly there. Or if it's a more luxury airline, you do the like, you know, $25,000 hotel room in Dubai, right? For Emirates. Like, I think you can build out the world like that. But I think airlines have really great opportunity to create YouTube shows.
You just made me think that I feel like a great way for a brand to realize if there's potential there is to just see like our creators already making content about this thing. So like, totally. Like if we think about staples of viral YouTube content, like airline seats, whether it's really budget ones or like, like the case in Iceland one from years ago, 60 million views, like the Emirates one. We think about car brands, like cars, you know, but I think looking at what's working and just seeing like, what if like, we can sponsor this, we can like do whatever, but like, what if we own this? I think it's really interesting. Yeah. I could totally see with airlines.
Totally.
Yeah. And then they play it on the plane.
Well, dude, we got to make this an annual thing, I think. Yeah. I think we got to keep updated because I like, there's so much to talk about and so much to explore. And also to just note like where the industry and where YouTube is, it'd be really fun to make this annual and go like, where are we in 2026? Did more brands join? Is the quote unquote meta different? Or are there new metas that have emerged? It's a really fun conversation.
Yeah. The YouTube roundtable. I love it.
I love it. All right. Thanks, Patty.
Thanks, Patty.
You got it. Pleasure.